You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, does 1 hour of exercise really offset a whole day of sitting? Is running bad for our knees? We'll talk with the author of a new book about the way our bodies have evolved and how that affects modern work and modern exercise. Now, authorities continue to investigate the recent mass shootings in Georgia and Colorado. Last week, a man opened fire at three different spas in Atlanta, killing 8 people. And on Monday, a man shot and killed 10 people at a supermarket in Boulder. President Biden and congressional Democrats are calling for tougher gun control measures. Republicans say such moves would violate the Second Amendment and that the focus should be on other root causes of crime. Our next guest says gun violence isn't just about politics or gun control and that we need to change the way we look at the problem. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to these recent mass shootings? Are you frustrated, scared? Do you see possible solutions, whether it's government regulation, societal change? What questions do you have for our guest about gun violence in America? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Zimmerman is the Marshall H. Becker Collegiate Professor of Public Health at the University of Michigan. He's also a professor of health behavior and health education, as well as psychology. He's director of the Prevention Research Center of Michigan and the Michigan Youth Violence Prevention Center. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, there's almost a script of how people from across the political spectrum respond when we see incidents of high-profile gun violence like this. What questions do you want people to start asking and thinking about when you see stories like this in the news?
Well, I think there's a couple of issues that I think are important. One is I try to take it out of the political realm of all the gun rights and gun control, and I reframe it as we need research and data to be able to think about ways that we can prevent the epidemic, really, of firearm death and injury. Just to give you some statistics, 10 to 24-year-olds in the United States die at about a rate of 20 per day. And we hear the news, and here I am on the radio because of these mass shootings. Mm-hmm. And in fact, as horrific as they are still relatively rare when we look at the 40,000 people in the United States that die each year from gun violence of one kind or another. And by gun violence, I mean it's homicide and suicide. Suicide accounts for 40% of gun-related deaths. It's about 60% attributable to homicide. So there's a problem out there with the ubiquity of guns and injuries that occur from them that goes far beyond these horrific events that happen all too often in the United States. And so I try to think about it as not a gun control issue. We didn't think about car crashes and car deaths as a car control issue. We talked about it as car safety, and we frame it as firearm safety. We, my colleagues and I, we have engaged gun owners. We don't vilify gun owners. This is not about taking away anybody's guns. This is about doing better than having 20 of our citizens between the ages of 10 and 24 die every day. It's 8 kids die every day from 0 to 17 from a firearm of one kind or another. And again, it's suicide. When a gun is involved, it occurs. It ends in death 90% of the time. So, and then you already want to know what the other 10% are like. And often a suicide is a impulsive act that especially younger people are engaged in, and there could be talked away from that edge, so to speak. So there's a lot more we can do that we have to do as a society. And I don't like calling it gun control. I just think that goes down a rabbit hole that is not helpful in trying to think about how do we make guns and guns and focus on gun safety.
I talked to a guest from the Violence Project a while back who said it's not just one gun violence problem. The solutions that might deal with, say, mass public shootings might be different from the suicides you were just talking about. Domestic violence or gang-related shootings might require different solutions. Is this something where we have to stop looking for, I guess, one magic solution and try to find solutions to all these kind of different but related problems?
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself, actually. Just to give a sense of this, about 5 years ago, 3 years ago, the number of firearm-related deaths surpassed the number of car deaths in the United States. And you're absolutely right. Suicide issues and homicide issues are really different underlying antecedents. And so you're right. There isn't one fix for all of this. But the sad part is, in the United States, we have not invested in the kind of research that we need to do to kind of understand the antecedents, understand what works, understand the different aspects of what it might look like in rural versus urban areas. Just to give you a sense of it, in 2017, the U.S. spent $1 million annually on research addressing firearm-related deaths among 1 to 17-year-old kids. That's compared to $88 million for motor vehicle deaths. If we spent money to really get the research base that we need to be able to give us informed answers, we would be able to tailor, depending on what where we are, what age groups we're looking at, whether it's a suicide or a homicide or gang-related, accidental mass shootings. You're absolutely right. They're all different, just like in cars. We saw that people who drank and drove, so we said you can't drink and drive. We saw data about being distracted when you're texting. So now there's laws about texting. But the answers aren't only policy. Some of them are behavioral. Educating people about how to have a firearm in the home safely, locked and unloaded, ammunition locked separately from the firearm, making it difficult for people in that household to reach that. That firearm, those are some of the things that we need to do more research, but we know that those kinds of things are certainly helpful.
Talking to Mark Zimmerman from the University of Michigan, a public health researcher there, talking about ways to reduce the impact of gun violence in the United States. You can join in with your questions and thoughts at 800-642-1234. Mark, I've seen some suggestions lately that one predictor to watch for the risk of various kinds of gun violence is past incidents of violence with or without a gun. Is that true, do you think? And if so, does it point us in any direction to say, how can we prevent that person who's committed assault, say, in the past, from becoming someone who commits a gun homicide in the future?
Well, yes. I mean, on almost every behavior that we engage in, past behavior is probably the single most best predictor of subsequent behavior. And yes, some of the precursors of violence with the firearm is starts with violence in other ways, whether it's using a weapon or not. So, yes, there are many of the similar factors that predict violent behavior often result in subsequently, potentially, in firearm behavior as well. But some of it is access. Suicide, obviously, is a different kind of a behavior than homicide. Homicide is a little bit more interpersonal directly. Suicide may result from interpersonal isolation or bullying. So some of those same factors do predict subsequent factors. Past violent behavior is a predictor of firearm behavior. Absolutely.
So what can we do with that, though? If we know that, is there a way that we can reach out to that person who has committed that violent act in the past and have help them not do it in the future? Or is it a matter of how do we make sure that person doesn't get a gun? I don't know. What kind of interventions can that point us toward?
Well, you know, that's the million-dollar question. And one of the things that we're looking at, some of the things that we have found is a way to reduce youth violence is to engage youth in positive community change, working with adults on those positive community change, helping them develop self-confidence in themselves and feeling some ownership in their community, thinking critically about their community. We have them do photo voice projects, and they start seeing a future for themselves, and they start seeing more positive and engaging in more positive behaviors and get more positive role models. That's a strategy that we have found, but there are many others. In many urban centers around homicide and crime are often correlated, and in many of our urban centers there are neighborhoods with lots of vacancy and greening, cleaning up the vacant lot, taking care of debilitated houses so that they're, at least if they're boarded up, they're boarded up in ways that don't show abandonment. We have found that those kinds of activities can reduce homicides. In terms of suicide, sometimes it's identifying the early signs and having people report those early signs. In schools around the country, there's anonymous reporting systems where if they see their friend is starting to give away everything that they really cared about and starting to withdraw from everybody, those are signs for potential psychological issues and depression that could result in a suicide or a suicide attempt. And there's ways of getting trying to help people identify those and report it to other people so that an intervention can happen before the tragedy occurs. So there are strategies and are efforts out there that are aimed at doing this kind of prevention work.
We're talking about gun violence in the United States and how to prevent it with Mark Zimmerman, professor of public health, health behavior and health education and psychology at the University of Michigan. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. Have you seen an anti-violence initiative in your own community? How did it work? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about efforts to prevent gun violence and gun suicide in the United States in all the various forms it can take. Mark Zimmerman is with us from the University of Michigan. He researches public health issues related to violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. Let's go to your calls now. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hello.
Hi, guys. This is a really great topic, and I agree 100% with your guest. It's something I've been thinking about for a long time. I used to be in the military. I used to work with weapons. And I know that people in America need to stop thinking of this as a gun problem and more of a people problem. We need to change our way of thinking. We need more safety. We need more people to understand what they're doing when they use guns. And like your guest said, we need these initiatives to bring this to the public so they know what they're doing and we can lower these crimes, these certain crimes. And I just wish that we could push this more a lot faster than other things that we seem to push.
Michael, thanks for the call. Mark?
I don't think we're going to get gun. You know, we are a gun culture. We have to just face that fact. There are 330 million or more guns in citizens' hands in the United States. Many people own more than one. A third to half of the U.S. citizens own a firearm. So it seems like a fool's errand to try to do anything about that. I think what we have to do is think about what are some of the policies, some of the technological and behavioral strategies we can do to avert the precursors to violence and gun violence, and we need research to kind of get an idea about what are the common factors that occur in different settings, and we need to sort of think about the root causes of some of this of the violence. And I don't think that it's any good to vilify gun owners or try to engage in the political debate. In the meantime, while we're doing all that, people are dying. And what we're also not talking about is, you know, besides the death, there's the family that's left behind and the trauma there. We find that people who are exposed to violence have all sorts of other psychological problems and physical problems later in life from the stress and the PTSD that they experience from that. I would say, you know, the key is to think ecologically, to think about the multi-level influences and how they our responses might be different. But at the end of the day, we have to kind of come together as a nation and decide that this is something we want to do something about. We decided we were going to land on the moon. We decide we're going to go to Mars. We can solve this problem. And we can solve this problem just like we're solving the problem with cars. We don't have to take people's cars away to make cars and cars safer to drive, people to learn how to drive them more safely, make our roads safer, and we can do a very similar model with firearms.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Owen next in Wyawega. Owen, hi.
Yeah, hi. Listening to this program, just thinking about ways we can report more as far as, you know, the media goes on the daily gun violence statistics. Trying to find my way through Google here and just see if I can find any accurate information day to day, which is hard to find when I navigate. So my question is, I remember on January 1st, I was listening to Indianapolis, Indiana news. There was 5 gun deaths overnight on January 1st in Indianapolis. But here in Wisconsin, we don't hear about that. And because it wasn't a mass shooting, we don't hear about it on the national media. So a lot of people, I think that we're just somewhat oblivious or ignorant to what's really going on with gun violence. And as a hunter and a gun owner myself, I also know, you know, the lethal capabilities of, say, a handgun compared to a deer rifle, there's a big difference. And an AR-15 isn't even as lethal as your high-powered deer rifle, but it's the choice based on some of these people's understanding of what they hear about on the media or on the Facebook or different things that they're listening to.
Owen, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there. First of all, Owen saying we see the reporting when there's the mass shooting. We don't necessarily see the day-by-day steady trickle that you were talking about earlier, Mark, the daily death toll.
Well, that's right. I mean, it goes back to, and thank you for that question or the comment about we don't pay attention. We don't even know much about these different instances, partly because for the last 30 years, the federal government was not funding any kind of firearm research. You know, it would be very useful if we could get information about where are the guns from, what happened in those incidents. And we're starting to be able to cull together those data to start seeing, are there patterns? What are the patterns? Where are the patterns? But without sort of the research base and the database and a common place for us to get that information, even if it's per state, makes it very difficult for us to understand what really is going on. And, you know, in defense of the media, you know, just like one car crash is not all that interesting, but a pile up on a highway is something that they would want to cover because a one car crash is too common. And it's the same thing with firearms. The mass shootings make the news. The everyday shootings do not make the news, and I think you're absolutely right. We need to start paying attention to all of it, and I think we need to have basically as a society decide that this is something we need to address and that we want to pay attention to. We decided as a society, both politically and just because we care about it, because people care about it, to do something about the opioid epidemic. Well, there were more people in the state of Michigan that died of firearms than opioids here last year. And yet millions and millions and millions of dollars are being spent to understand what we need to do to staunch the opioid epidemic. And I sound like a broken record at this point, but we do need to lift the veil, avoid this the conversation that is this divisive about rights and about the politics of this. This isn't about taking guns away. This is about making guns safer. This is about making our society safer. Now, it's not rocket science, but we have to decide that we want to make an investment.
And as you mentioned, just in our last minute, that lack of investment, federal funds very limited in places like the CDC to look at gun violence as a public health issue. Do you see that starting to change at all?
Yes, I'm very encouraged that the Congress has identified about $50 million a year to start to begin studying this, and that we're in year two of that funding cycle. And I think we could increase that. And partly, we can also start lifting the veil that there was a long time where we weren't allowed to study firearms if we had federal dollars. We were restricted. So those restrictions are lifting as well. And I think that's kind of what we need. And I think if we decide, like we did, we've spent billions of dollars on car safety. And now people automatically get into a car and buckle their seatbelt. They don't have to, they don't think about it anymore. Similarly, our car people, a selling point of our cars is the safety features it has. We need to start to change the culture around firearms as well in the same kind of way, both in terms of research and in terms of, you know, what's acceptable and what is the, how we're going to live in a society where guns are as ubiquitous as they are.
We'll leave it there. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, and thank you to the callers.
Mark Zimmerman is professor of public health, health behavior, and health education and psychology at the University of Michigan. He's director of the Prevention Research Center of Michigan and the Michigan Youth Violence Prevention Center. We talked to him about gun violence in the United States, what it might take to reduce the numbers. Coming up after the news, an evolutionary biologist explores the many myths of exercise and tells us why we shouldn't feel bad for not wanting to exercise at all. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, public health officials are urging people to avoid non-essential flights, but travelers are taking to the skies in pre-pandemic numbers. Where's everyone going? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, in a world where office jobs and TV watching are the norm, we assume that exercise is good and necessary and that we should want to exercise and sometimes feel bad when we don't want to. Entire industries have popped up to encourage us to get active, from special clothes to wear, equipment to buy, and gyms and clubs where we pay money to wear ourselves out. But in human evolution, this modern form of exercise is a new concept. Our next guest says it's something our ancestors would have been baffled by, and that we can get more benefit from exercise if we realize how unnatural it is. Daniel Lieberman is the Edwin M. Lerner II Professor of Biological Sciences in the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology at Harvard. He's the author of several books, including his latest, Exercised, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. We spoke with him in January about his book. Here's our conversation. Well, this fundamental idea, it's right there in your subtitle. We did not evolve to exercise, at least not the way we think of exercise these days. Why not?
Well, it's important to make a distinction between physical activity, which is just moving, right? You know, when you go to the supermarket and get stuff, or go climb a tree because you want to get a cat out of it or whatever, right? That's just physical activity. But exercise is a special kind of physical activity. It's discretionary. It's voluntary. It's unnecessary physical activity that we plan to do for the sake of health and fitness. And until recently, people had to be physically active, but they also were limited in calories, and so they avoided physical activity when it wasn't beneficial, when it didn't have any sort of immediate need or wasn't fun.
And you spend a lot of time in the book, well, and in your career, looking to a modern hunter-gatherer societies for, you know, an idea of what all of our ancestors who are hunter-gatherers, how they might have behaved, the kind of work they do. You've been all over the world looking at this. And yeah, in talking to people, this idea that you would run, but you weren't chasing or being chased by something is baffling to people who aren't living and are sitting in a desk world.
Yeah, it's true. I love to ask people, you know, and there are cultures, you know, like the famous Tarahumara who do run long distances, or in Kenya, where I've done most of my field work, where we work with in the area where a lot of the world's best runners come from. And when you ask people, you know, when do you run? They look at me like, well, when a goat gets loose, you know, that's when they run. But going for like a 5-mile jog in the morning, which is what I like to do, they think I'm crazy. Nobody does that. And, you know, if you think about it, it makes sense. Because for most people until recently, and for many people still on the planet, you know, they don't have an unlimited supply of energy, of calories. And so calories you spend, you know, going for a 5-mile jog, that's 500 calories, is calories you don't spend taking care of your body or helping, you know, your children. So it's kind of a strange thing that we do today, but we never used to do.
And this isn't just an academic exercise. You're looking at this to learn about how we in the United States say how we can get motivated to do kinds of physical activity that are healthy for us. If we don't understand how weird this concept of exercise is, it's going to be harder to get us to motivate ourselves. How can learning from these other societies help us out here?
Exactly. Well, here's the thing, right? In the United States, the way we get people to exercise is we have two ways to do it. One is we've industrialized it, we've commodified it, we've commercialized it, right? We sell exercise and we buy exercise and we go to the gym and whatever. There's nothing wrong with that, right? But that's one of the ways we do it. And then the other way we do it is we've medicalized it. We prescribe it, you know. We exercise is medicine. And the evidence is out there, right? We know that these two different ways in which we try to get people to exercise just basically doesn't work all that well. According to many, many different government agencies and other studies, only about 20% of adult Americans get 150 minutes a week of physical activity, of moderate to vigorous physical activity. So that's like a brisk walk, right? That's 21 minutes a day, right? And that's 150 minutes a week is what every major organization in the world, health organization in the world, considers to be the minimum amount of physical activity somebody should get. So if only 20% are doing it on this sort of medicalized, commercialized perspective, we need to try a different tack. And I think that an evolutionary and anthropological approach can help us do better.
Now, one telling thing in your book for me, I've got a treadmill in my basement. I got it for free, and I use it, you know, when I can't get outside for a walk. Once upon a time, the treadmill was part of a prison sentence. People were confined and made to walk on treadmills as a punishment.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, if you think treadmill is torture, you're in good company, because the treadmill was actually invented by a man named William Cubitt. He was hired to produce. You know, they were worried that prisoners in Victorian jails in England were kind of relaxing too much and not being punished enough. So they created this treadmill to make people trudge for hours and hours and hours. And you know, people like Oscar Wilde, for example, were required to trudge on treadmills for hours and hours and hours. So if you don't like a treadmill, and I put people on treadmills for a living, but I don't enjoy them much either. And if you feel it's a form of torture, there's a reason.
Talking to Daniel Lieberman about his new book, Exercised, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. You look at exercise and physical activity, Daniel, and you also look at inactivity and, you know, sitting. And I'm one of these people, I hear sitting's bad. Okay, I stand and host the show. I have standing workstations. But in looking at these other cultures, hunters and gatherers and elsewhere, they sit a lot too. Tell us what you learned from how and when they sit.
Yeah, well, so I start the book off by thinking about physical inactivity, because if you want to understand activity, you also have to understand inactivity. And you can't exercise all day long, right? You know, and the reason I called the book Exercised is, to be exercised, to be anxious, nervous, worried, harassed, confused, right? And we have made people exercised about the topic of physical activity and inactivity. And a good example is sitting, right? We've demonized sitting. We say it's like the new smoking. Your chair is out to kill you, you know. And you can read all kinds of horrible statistics out there about how smoking is, you know, sitting is, you know, unnatural. But I think most people know that instinctively that smoking and sitting aren't the same thing, and that sitting is nowhere as near as harmful as smoking. And it turns out that it's also not, it's not unnatural. If you go into a hunter-gatherer camp or a village of farmers, places like where I work, people are sitting most of the time when they're not working, and they're not working crazy hard. So hunter-gatherers work about 2.25 hours a day. The rest of the time, they're in camp sitting. So sitting itself isn't so bad, or it's not unnatural. It's just that there are better and worse ways to sit. So rather than demonizing sitting, why don't we give people the real information that they need to know, which is that break up your bouts of sitting so that you don't sit for long, uninterrupted periods of time, and also try to sit more actively. It turns out it's helpful to, you know, squat or not have a chair with a back, etc. So using some of your muscles. And, you know, evidence shows that it's not work time sitting that's associated with poor health outcomes. It's leisure time sitting. So if you work all day at a desk, don't panic, because if you get home, you know, you can go do a little bit of physical activity, you know, go for a half hour walk or something like that. You're gonna do fine.
You tackle in each chapter, really, the book, myths about exercise and inactivity. One of them has to do, getting back to motivation here, with the idea of just do it. Just do it as an effective tool of motivation, not such an effective strategy. Why not?
Well, the evidence shows it doesn't work. If you just tell people to exercise, that's not going to get them to exercise. We just know that, right? And I think there's a deep and fundamental reason for that, because for millions of years, for thousands and thousands of generations, right? People struggle to get enough food, right? And to get the food, they had to be physically active, but to then spend extra energy on physical activity that didn't have any kind of benefit wasn't helpful, right? So it was selected against. So we evolved to be physically active for two reasons and two reasons only. One is when it's necessary, and the other is when it's rewarding, especially socially rewarding. So, like, for example, going for a dance, right? Where you get to show off and meet people and form social bonds, or play. That's another form of physical activity that's rewarding, right? And that helps build skills, and we teach each other not to be, you know, bad sports and stuff like that. So if we want to help each other be physically active, we have to find ways to make it both necessary and socially rewarding. And the best way to do that is make it fun and make it social and make it playful, or use commitment contracts. You know, one idea is to treat exercise like education. Education is as abnormal as exercise, right? Nobody learned geology or geography or you know, algebra or, you know, states capitals back in the old day, right? But how do we make school work? We make it necessary, and we also make it fun. We make it social, and there's also, you know, all kinds of things that make kids want to go to school. We should treat exercise exactly the same way.
We are revisiting our conversation with Daniel Lieberman, professor of biological sciences at Harvard University. He joined us in January to talk about his book, Exercised, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. Coming up, we'll hear the rest of our conversation, including the ways that exercise and spirituality can sometimes go hand in hand. That's coming up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're revisiting our January conversation with Daniel Lieberman, professor of biological sciences in the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology at Harvard University. He was with us to talk about his latest book titled Exercised, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. As part of the conversation, we heard from Central Time listener James in Spooner. Here's his take on exercise.
I just wanted to call in and let you know what motivated me. Basically, a couple years before this COVID thing happened, I kind of upped my exercise routine. And what I have a tendency to do is read scriptures, do a little bit of meditation. Then I put some praise music or just music on, because I'm a musician too. And I do an exercise routine for about 45 minutes to an hour. I do 277 sit-ups, 77 push-ups, 77 deep knee bends, some hurdler stretches and leg lifts and stuff to go with. Now, I do it, or got my motivation kind of from the fact, or my belief that my body is the temple of God, and I try to do maintenance to his temple every day. It helps me keep from having depression. It helps me be happy. And my quality of life for the day, for today, is
James,
better.
Thank you so much for sharing that. You gave us a lot to work with there. First of all, Daniel, you were talking about reward, part of what will motivate us to do exercise is reward. James saying his reward, it sounds like, is he realizes he feels better. His mood is better. His depression goes away. Is that part of the thing that can help us get motivated?
Well, absolutely. Well, here's the thing, right? First of all, it's wonderful that James has, you know, got this fantastic routine and it's clearly working for him.
Yeah.
The problem is that a lot of people struggle to get into that kind of mode, right? Into that kind of routine. And one of the problems is that the reward that you get from exercise, what makes James feel great after exercise, all the good stuff happens after you exercise, not before you exercise. So dopamine is the neurotransmitter that gets released and synthesized, you know, when we're physically active, and that's the molecule of more. That's the neurotransmitter which says, "Do it again. That was awesome," right? The problem is that dopamine doesn't happen before you do it; it happens after you do it. So people struggle to kind of get that, right? And like, I'm no different. I mean, in the morning when I go for a run, I'm mostly a runner, right? I often don't want to leave, right? But I know that when I get back, I'll be glad I did it. And I kind of coerce myself. I meet a friend, you know, and then I have to be there at 6 a.m. on the corner of the street, you know, where I live, to meet him. But you know, it's the problem is that most people are struggling to get where James is at. And I think that what we need to do is compassionately help them do it. Virtue signaling is not effective, right? You know, letting people know just how good you know, people have like the 26.2 stickers on the back of their car. You know, that doesn't help people run, right? It just kind of makes people irritated, I suspect. So we need to find ways to be compassionate and understand that people who don't exercise, they're not lazy. There's nothing wrong with them. They're actually normal. They're completely normal human beings.
Another point James brought up is that he's motivated in part here by his faith. And that reminds me, some of the societies you looked at, the physical activity that isn't directly connected to survival often has some kind of ritual or maybe spiritual purpose. Is there something we can learn from that, whether we're drawing on our spirituality or creating exercise rituals, even if they're secular in nature, to get us motivated?
Absolutely. I mean, I had the good fortune of spending a lot of time doing research with some Native American groups, the Tarahumara in Mexico, and they are famous for these long distance runs. And what people don't often know about them is that their main motivation for these long runs is it's a form of prayer. It's beautiful. It's spiritual. It's really moving. And so it's a way that shows that physical activity for them is meaningful. It's right. And you know, how many kids in America grow up thinking, you know, that they want to, you know, show their faith or whatever by you know, running long distances. It's just not something that we do, right? But for almost every Native American peoples, that's an important, running is an important part of sort of their spirituality, of their existence. And I think we can learn a lot from that. It's wonderful.
Thanks for the call. James gave us a lot to talk about there. Talking to Daniel Lieberman about his book, Exercised, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. All right, so just do it isn't going to get us going. Shaming each other isn't going to get us going. You've started to touch on this, the social aspects, the fun aspects for that person who's just not feeling it, not getting that exercise. How can they evaluate themselves and figure out the kind of things that are going to work for them?
Well, I mean, I think we all know what we enjoy, right? I mean, I think that, you know, the problem is that a lot of the prescriptions that we get, you know, are like taking cod liver oil, right? And you know, that's not fun either, but at least it gets over in a few seconds, right? You just gulp it down, you deal with the nasty flavor, and then you're on your way, right? But exercise is a more prolonged and a harder sort of barrier to overcome. So the trick is to find something you enjoy doing. So if you don't like being on a treadmill, or you can't find a podcast or a TV show to watch that makes it enjoyable, find something else that you find enjoyable or fun. So that's I think the first thing. Secondly, you don't need to do a huge amount. Data show that just a little bit is incredibly beneficial. If you just exercise, if you're not exercising at all, just a few minutes a day can have enormous benefits. So some is better than none, and you don't need to run a marathon or do 170 something push-ups or whatever, which is great, but you don't need to do that. And then the final thing is think about a commitment contract, right? This is how schools work. This is how so many things work, right? Where you can designate somebody as a referee or agree to meet somebody. Like I on Thursday mornings, I meet friends to do intervals. You know, we run on the track, right? And I never want to be there at 7 in the morning on this cold, miserable track, right? But I have to meet them, right? So it's a contract I have with them. And then we cheer each other on and we help each other. And that makes it fun. It doesn't have to be running. It can be walking. It can be dancing. It can be anything. But commitment contracts have been shown to be extremely effective. And we can, there's so many ways to do them.
Now, there's a big portion of the population that does exercise. And I think thinks a lot about and argues a lot about what the best kind of exercise is. You tackle that problem. What answer do you offer people, those non-exercisers, as to what kind of exercise would be best?
I would encourage we stop thinking that way. I mean, that's part of the medicalization of exercise, right? That it's like there's an optimal dose. You know, like when you take your coronavirus, right? There's a particular dose you have to take. Well, exercise doesn't work that way, right? Everybody's different. We all have different goals, whether you're male or female or young or old or fit or non-fit, whether you're worried about Alzheimer's or osteoporosis or heart disease or whatever. It's all different for all of us. The important thing is to do something. And but if you are going to try to do it as well as possible, it's pretty simple. You know, some is better than none. Cardio is the bedrock of every exercise program, but it's important to do weights a little bit, you know, some strength training, especially as we get older, and just mix it up. And, you know, that's far more important than tuning the dose just right, because there is no optimal dose. That's a fictitious thought.
In our last minute or so, Daniel, you've been all over the world looking at exercise. You started off in life, as I read you, not an exercise guy. Do you feel like you've learned a lot from the people you've worked with around the world?
Oh my gosh, it's been very inspiring and fun and wonderful. I'm very into participant observation. So every time I've gone and studied people doing stuff, I've tried to do it myself. And I found it humbling, but also empowering, because I've learned, you know, if you ever met me, you would not think of me as an athlete. I'm not fast. I'm not strong. I hid in closet during, you know, to avoid gym when I was a kid. You know, I was picked last for every team. And yet I've learned that, you know, just basic normal human physical activity is quite impressive and wonderful. And we're all athletes. We focus too much on elite athletes. We focus too much on weight loss. Just what your average human being can do is marvelous. And here's a final fact for fun. Your average sedentary American, you know, so your couch potato, right, is still more active than your average wild chimpanzee.
Well, that's inspiring. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Daniel Lieberman, professor of biological sciences in the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology at Harvard University. We talked to him in January about his latest book. It's called Exercised: Why Something We Never Evolved to Do Is Healthy and Rewarding. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow at 7, Bayfield County leads Wisconsin in vaccination rates. A county health official joins the show to tell us how things are working there and whether there are lessons to be learned for other communities. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk with Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan about some big issues facing the nation and Congress in particular right now, including gun control, immigration, COVID-19, and infrastructure spending. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.